Today's episode is brought to you by Slate House Publishing, recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
All right, guys, we're back, and we're going to start off with the winter movie review for Slate House Publishing's Lit Bits. And we're going to start off today with a movie called Studio 666.
Curtis, might I point out, Curtis gets this right on the first try.
I'm just saying, why are we not having him do the intros every time?
I just sit quietly by most of the time, don't I? All right, starting off, Studio 666 starring the Foo Fighters, which is Dave Grohl, Pat Smear, Jenna Ortega. Who's Jenna Ortega?
She is an up-and-coming actress. She is a young actress. She's going to appear on our list a couple of times, actually.
She's new? Okay.
She's new, yeah. She's probably like 20 years old. I mean, she's young, but she's coming... She's popping up on this list a couple of times, and she's also coming out with some good movies. She's also recently been tapped to star in Netflix's series Wednesday as Wednesday Adams.
Oh, Wednesday. Okay. All right.
So, we just talked about that.
Which we just talked about earlier
in this season.
Rotten Tomatoes gives this movie 81%, which is very generous for Rotten Tomatoes, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought so.
For Rotten Tomatoes.
So you saw this movie. I did not end up getting to see it. What were your thoughts?
I love this movie. Like, this movie didn't do great at the box office, but I think it's going to be a cult classic. I think the Foo Fighters understand comedy. Obviously, if you've watched their videos, they understand comedy really well. But they put those elements into horror, so they make this great horror comedy. What's interesting about this movie is that it is based on, so apparently when they were doing Medicine at Midnight, their 10th album, they recorded it at a mansion in Encino, and there were some weird happenings going on during this thing, but because they signed a non-disclosure agreement with the owner of the mansion, they couldn't like come right out and talk about the hauntings and the stuff they experienced at this mansion. So this is a fictionalized version of what they experienced, obviously, and it gets crazy, but it's hilarious. And you can tell that as much fun as they had a lot of fun making this film. Like, it was a blast.
And, I mean, I know you say that it didn't make a whole lot of money, but I feel like, I don't know, for me anyway, like, I don't think a project like this is ever about like a huge return on investment.
No,
right?
No, this was a labor of love, totally.
Yeah,
this was totally a labor of love.
And I mean, it seems like the kind of project that is specifically designed for cult following status, right?
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. And obviously, it promotes the band,
which is
worth so much money. So this little project really is like a promotional tidbit that they're probably doing.
One man's tidbit
is another man's. Massive project, right?
Right. Yeah.
They created a fictional band called like Dream Whisper or something like that. That's like a heavy metal slasher band, and they recorded an entire album of songs for this fictional band.
Oh wow!
That they're supposed to be releasing as well. And it was amazing. It was really the amount of energy that they put into this project, like all their projects. It's just fascinating. I'm just the biggest fan of the Foo Fighters.
That's cool. So there's more to this than just the movie.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's
totally,
really cool.
Totally.
They're really fantastic people. I get to kind of brag. I got to see a Foo Fighters concert in my friend's garage. The Foo Fighters came and played for 50 people.
Oh, wow.
And they just set up GoPros all over the garage. They called it the garage tour, I think.
Wow.
And basically, it's a sweepstakes. You send in a picture of your garage, and if they like it, they'll come play a show in it, right?
Oh, wow.
But there are stipulations about the contest. If you win, you can't tell people that you won. It has to be you have to follow all these rules or else you're out and you don't get it. So my friend was actually the runner-up, and the first place winner of this blabbed on social media that she had won.
Oh wow.
And they said, well, guess what, now you don't get it. And which is horrible. Like, I can't imagine the heartbreak for that girl. But my friend was over at our house, and she got the phone call and found out. She started screaming her head off, and we got really concerned. We thought somebody had died or something. And she said, we got the Foo Fighters. And I was like, what does that mean? We got the Foo Fighters. Who got them? How do you get them? And she explained what was going on. And she explained what was going on. And she said, and you guys are obviously invited. And I was like, oh my God. So yeah, the year was 2010, and I'm standing in a garage in the suburbs of Dallas, just watching the Foo Fighters. Like, they were from me to you. They were like right there. And I got to talk to Dave Grohl and tell him how cool I thought he was. And he signed my Wasting Light CD with a... Well, first he gave me the CD for free, and then he signed it with a silver Sharpie.
Oh, wow.
And I've got it, and I'm so proud of it. But that is one of the coolest stories I
have.
Can
I borrow it and never give it back?
Sure, yeah. I need to put it up here in the studio somewhere.
That would be cool.
It's yeah. really cool. But yeah, it started raining, and they had to take off pretty quick. But man, what a day. What freaking surreal day. So yeah, they're kind of known for reaching out to fans in kind of a real meaningful way, right?
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
Really, really cool band.
Yeah, yeah.
Super cool guys.
But that's not the only movie we have on the list. What else do we have?
Sorry. What were we talking about?
Oh, we were talking about movies.
And yeah, I mean, the story about that is way cooler than any musician story I have.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure it's a great movie, but yeah, I don't know. What do we have next? Nightmare Alley, featuring Guillermo del Toro.
He directed it.
He's the director.
I mean, yeah, that's what D means, right? Okay. Yeah. What did I say?
I should have.
What did I say?
Featuring?
Featuring. That means he's like acting in it, right?
Yeah, I should have prepped Curtis with my script notes before I.
In a way, he is featured in the movie.
Yeah, it's got
as director.
His name. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, this one was based on a book by William Lindsay Gresham. Did you ever end up reading the book?
I've got it. It's on my TBR. So.
Yeah. Okay.
I haven't yet.
So Del Toro is probably my favorite director. He has done some amazing projects in the past. I felt like this one was actually some pretty good noir. I mean, noir is kind of a difficult genre to approach because if you do it really, really well, it's amazing. But if you don't do it well, it can be really shitty.
Right.
And unfortunately, I think there are a lot of bad noir projects. You know, for example, Reminiscence, right? Just an absolutely terrible neo-noir. But this one, I think, really tries at least to kind of get to the roots of what noir fiction is trying to do, right? I mean, it's called noir fiction because it is dark. It is really bleak.
Yeah.
And I think one of the hallmarks of noir fiction is that you have a protagonist anyway, who ends up not necessarily in a good space by the end of the story, right? I don't know many noir stories that have a happy ending.
Right, yeah.
But I think what makes a noir story work is that it's constantly trying to assess the human condition and the flaws of human characters as they relate to one another, right?
Right, right.
So a good noir protagonist should be someone who is intimately flawed, you know, someone that you can really tell is flawed, but is also kind of sympathetic. You know, you can't help but root for him to make the right decisions, even though you know, watching this movie, like, he's not gonna make good decisions.
Right, which can be frustrating and drive away the average.
But it's what drives the drama, right? It's what drives the story forward.
Yeah.
So it's a little long, I felt, because this is like a 2.5 hour movie.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, I could probably do without 20 or 30 minutes of it. It's a carny movie, which I also am kind of not so into, because I think a lot of movies about carnies really focus on like them being freaks and not really like the exploitation really of people who already don't have the same advantages or the same privileges as the rest of us.
There's
that's
a lot
the, that's
to
the route
there.
I felt like this movie took is it didn't portray them as freaks. It showed the disparity of their condition.
It's the carnival's job to display them as freaks, right?
Yeah.
If you're going to do a piece on them, you dig a little deeper, right?
Yeah. Because, I mean, the carnival itself is really exploitative, right?
Absolutely.
Like, the whole point is, like, come look at our freaks. But they also, you know, keep the freaks working for them. I say that. I don't mean that they're actual freaks, but you know what I mean.
We'll put quotes around freaks.
Yeah, we'll put quotes around
freaks.
I mean, they keep these...
The alleged freaks.
They keep these people working for them, basically under the premise, like, you'll never work anywhere else.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You should be grateful for your exploitation.
That's like
because
a typical...
what else are you going to do? You're just going to be a bum on the streets.
Right, it's like a typical tactic with that type of thing, isn't
right.
it? Like, you need me. You can't go anywhere else.
Yeah.
evil.
Yeah. So I feel dark. Like, yeah, the thesis of this movie was basically like, you know, people are kind of horrible to each other.
Right.
And, and like constantly looking to exploit one another, only leads to like self-destruction.
Right.
It is not anything that is really productive. And so we see these like cycles of people just like consuming other people around them. And then, you know, kind of like the spiritual death that comes from that constant looking to exploit one another.
Right.
So I yeah.
That's a great way to describe all that.
Yeah. I good movie.
I liked it.
Yeah. I liked it a lot. I thought it was really, yeah. really good.
Yep.
Strong performances too. I
thought Bradley Cooper, Kate Blanchett, Toni Collette, Willem Dafoe.
Yeah. Rooney Mara was in there too.
Rooney Mara.
Consummately terrifying, Willem Dafoe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like Willem Dafoe. I could have used 20 more minutes of Kate Blanchett personally.
yeah.
Yeah, she plays kind of the femme fatale of this movie, I think. Uh-huh. Because there's always one of those, right? Like, like in any noir movie, you're gonna have like the well-meaning, almost virginal character, which I think Rooney Mara is the one who plays that. And then you have like the Black Widow, you know, like the spider in woman's clothing. Right? Yeah. That's Kate Blanchett in this case.
Yeah,
it's a good movie.
What's next? Scream?
Scream.
The original Scream?
No, a new Scream movie came out.
So I'm reading who it's starring, and it says Neve Campbell, David Arquette, Courtney Cox, and I'm like, why are we reviewing a movie that's 20-something years old now?
No, well, because, and they make a joke about this in the movie.
They
like,
do.
Like, they titled it Scream, but it's actually Scream 5. And they're like, yeah. How in the movie, they're like, because they're talking about the Stab movies, you know, and they're like, it's Stab 8. Why are they just calling it Stab? They're like, it's so pretentious.
Scream has always been self-deprecating in that way.
They really did a good job of bringing that meta back to the.
It's kind of the meta slasher, right? Yeah. Like the slasher about slashers. I think what set Scream, like the original movie, apart for me was its self-awareness.
Right.
And this is like your mileage is going to vary on this because either you're a slasher fan who can kind of come into a meta slasher like this and see it both as a slasher, but then also a commentary on the culture surrounding slasher films.
Right.
And really enjoy that kind of meta commentary. You know, it's very postmodern. I think that Scream, at least the first one, kind of broke the mold a little bit in representing to us, having a fresh take on what was a very tired genre
by the
1990s, right?
And around that time, that was like a popular thing to do. They were doing it with, it's weird. They did Scary Movie, which is a spoof on Scream, but what's funny is that Scream was already doing that to itself, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like in the late 90s, we reached this pinnacle of like, okay, clearly this genre is done, and so we're just gonna go, and just have fun with it. And and Scream ended up being really fun, but it was a pretty scary movie. I was really young when it came out.
It's a good
96.
96. Yeah.
What works about it is that it is a competent slasher in and of itself.
Yeah. Right.
And I think that slashers are having kind of a moment right now, at least culturally. You know, we've had a number of slasher projects, I think just in like this winter we've seen.
Even in books like Stephen Graham Jones's My Heart is a Chainsaw.
Yeah, I was going to say books too. I mean, it's not just Stephen Graham Jones because he writes a lot of slashers.
Yeah.
He's been writing slashers for
But that's
for
the one that's
years.
Most recently come out that's really kind of received
as well
some accolades.
As Grady Hendrix's Final Girl Support Group, which in itself is also a meta slasher, right? I think that this movie is like a meta slasher.
Slasher Inception.
This is where, yes, it is the slasher Inception. This is where it gets weird because it's not just having a meta commentary about slashers. It's having a meta commentary about the meta commentary slasher.
Right.
Yeah.
And that level of like self-referentiality just makes this movie so much weirder and like so much, I think, more fun because it's not just trying to have a comment about the state of like the movie industry
right.
in terms of slashers, but almost kind of like a commentary on the state of the movie industry itself.
Oh, Harvey Weinstein had like everything to do with these movies too, right?
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
I mean, he
produced, yeah, his name is all over at least the first two, probably all of them.
I don't expect that they made any references to him in this movie, but too much, right? Too far.
What they do interesting for me is again, I mentioned that new actress, Jenna Ortega, and she is, you know, at the beginning of every Scream movie, somebody's attacked and they're killed. Well, she's the girl that's attacked at the beginning, but she's not killed.
Oh,
she's hospitalized and she serves to tell everybody, hey, Ghostface is back. And that's what kind of brings everybody together.
She lived to tell everybody.
Yeah. And then she becomes like one of the final girls, which is kind of cool too.
It's kind of a spoiler, but.
Screw it.
Yeah, we spoil everything though.
That was a micro spoiler.
Yeah.
It's a shame upset. It's a shame that Wes Craven is not around to direct this one.
Yeah, that's and they pay homage.
Weird Jeremy moment, man.
Spider-Man, No Way Home.
I love that movie.
Holy shit.
I thoroughly enjoyed that.
You're not alone. I mean, this...
Willem Dafoe again.
A $1.86 billion.
What's cool about this is they bring back the villains from the first two franchises of Spider-Man. So I mean, it's Alfred Molina's Dr. Octopus. It's Willem Dafoe's Green Goblin.
Right.
It's Jamie Foxx's Electro. It's like all the original. Yeah.
You want to talk like meta, you know, meta movies, right? I feel like this movie is like a time capsule of Spider-Man of the last, 20 years?
Yeah.
I remember skipping school when I was a teenager. My mom had me skip school to go see that Tobey Maguire Spider-Man
it was
on opening
day. Big
it was
deal.
A big fucking deal.
I mean, they had that song with Chad Kroeger from Nickelback. Believe in heroes.
What I think made this movie such an amazing.
You just pissed off all the Nickelback fans out there.
Yeah, I didn't sing it right.
Nickelback has fans.
Oh, and then Corey Taylor of Slipknot also did a song for that movie. They had two major musical releases. That movie was such a big deal. It was blown up.
Well, Curtis, should I point out then that it's not a misprint on the script that Tobey Maguire is in this film along with Andrew Garfield? Yeah. They reprised their Peter Parker Spider-Man roles.
Cat's out of the bag,
what?
Right? Okay, yeah. So one of the things that made this movie so amazing an experience for me was that, you know, my mother took me to go see the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man. In fact, my mother has taken me to see basically every Spider-Man movie up until the Tom Holland era. And I took her to go see Civil War when Tom Holland was, you know, he first came in as Spider-Man. And she had no idea that Spider-Man was joining the MCU at that point. So that was like it was a mind-blowing reveal for her. She was like, Spider-Man's in this movie? And I'm like, yes, Spider-Man is in this movie. But then we went to see this one, and I was like, have you seen any promotional material for this movie whatsoever? And my mother was like, no, I really haven't. I don't know how. She hadn't seen any ads. She hadn't seen any posters or anything. She was coming into this movie completely cold, and she had just watched the entire MCU up until this point. So I brought her to the movie, and we sat down, and as we were watching it, you know, like Doctor Strange shows up, and she's like, Doctor Strange is in this movie? And I was like, oh my gosh. Like, she doesn't even know. So Doctor Strange shows up, and then Alfred Molina shows up as Doc Ock, and she's like, Dr. Octopus is in this movie?
Just over and over.
Seriously, every single time. It was just, she was like, this is such a real treat. Like, Willem Dafoe's back? You know, she was like, and what's hilarious is that, like, she didn't catch on to, like, it was leading up to. So by the time Andrew Garfield shows up as Spider-Man, she was like, what?
She spit take. Yeah, soda she was everywhere.
Like, what? And she was like, I had no idea. And then Tobey Maguire shows up and she's like, what? We watched this movie 20 years ago. You know, it was just such a wholesome moment.
It's hard to believe it was 20 years ago. Oh, that, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That movie was so good.
And to bring it full circle, in a few months, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness is coming out, and guess who's directing it?
Who?
Sam Raimi.
Who directed the first Spider-Man.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So talk about coming around full circle.
Sam Raimi has major horror like creds too.
Yeah.
I think that's excited.
My wife's crazy about Doctor Who. I bet she's going to be excited about that. The Cursed. The next movie, The Cursed.
I didn't know much about this.
Okay, so this movie is a werewolf movie. It's a period piece set in England, and basically, you know, landlord goes and kills a bunch of gypsies, ends up with a werewolf curse on his hand.
Yeah.
Right? I think this, it's nothing that I haven't seen before, in at least in terms of like kind of traditional werewolf story.
The idea that the curse has passed through the teeth that they make out of these like silver, they make the
out of the silver from Judas Iscariot, right? That's the other, that's kind of an interesting piece of lore.
Yeah.
For this movie.
They make a set of teeth that possesses like this person to wear them. And when the person wears them, they bite a nearby individual and that individual becomes the werewolf.
Yeah. Oh. Right. And then this werewolf like, you know, charges around town.
But it's just executed so well, I think.
It is executed so well. And I think that what works is, at least for me, is like not only is this a really cool werewolf movie with some werewolf transformation stuff that I have never seen before. It's so fucking wild.
Like the way they shift into the werewolf visually?
The werewolf itself doesn't look like a dog with fur. Yeah,
right.
It's creepy. I think the design for the werewolf creatures are really awesome.
I think I've been a little disinterested for a while about those types of things because it starts to look the same. You know, every time they do a werewolf thing, it's the same looking werewolf every time.
How do you innovate on a werewolf movie? Right.
Right.
And I don't know that this movie really does innovate a whole lot, but what it does do, I think, is dig into like the human weight, if you will, of it, like a curse like the werewolf curse. And what I think this movie also does really well is present, you know, kind of a commentary on the sins of you know, call it imperialism or really the sins of just rich, wealthy white landowners.
Right.
And the way that they treat the indigenous peoples of a region. You know, I don't necessarily know that the gypsies, quote unquote, in this case, in this movie, were necessarily the indigenous people of Britain.
Right.
But they are, you know, like refugees, right?
The symbolism is kind of still there.
They've come to this land. I think they actually, you know what? I think they do lay claim to the land.
They did. Yeah, that was the source of contention because they were like, you know, we own this land before you guys. Now, I don't think they were indigenous, but I think they had just a stake on the land.
Yeah, they had a land stake. And the lord of this land decides like, no, I'm not going to recognize that. And he has them slaughtered in one of the most breathtakingly horrific shots of any movie.
Really?
That was very powerful.
The slaughtering of the.
It's a static shot on like a tripod, basically, or whatever.
Like they a wide shot, like a
big,
distance.
A big wide shot. So you see the distance of the entire encampment of these peoples as the Lord's men, you know, come in. And brutally murder every single one of them.
Oh,
yeah.
It is incredibly well choreographed and just one of the most kind of breathtaking and horrifyingly violent sequences.
So you're getting the gravity of the situation kind of
as
a whole, right?
Yeah. And I mean, it it feels like it's such a super long shot. I bet if you actually timed that shot, it is not that long.
Probably.
It's maybe like a minute and a half or 2 minutes long. But it feels like, I mean, the weight of that whole sequence is just unbelievable.
A little bit of trauma there.
Yeah. I think it does some stuff really, really well.
Yeah.
And I think that on the whole, I felt very positive about this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In comparison,
the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Now, as a resident of Texas, this is particularly scary for me. Now, I haven't seen this incarnation of it, but I've had my share of being completely disgusted and horrified by this series.
I've never been much into these movies, so I did not watch this one. So
it's grotesque. They're grotesque. They're extremely violent.
This movie is. Yeah, I mean, it does not hold back on its violence.
Yeah.
It is one of the bloodiest slashers I think I've seen in a long, long time.
Sarah Yarkin, Elsie Fisher, and Mark Burnham.
Yeah, really not big names at all.
Which is what you want for a movie like that, you know? You want some... If your characters are unrecognizable, you feel a little more isolated in the...
So I think this is what makes the Texas Chainsaw series kind of interesting is that so many of these Texas Chainsaw filmmakers, because there are how many movies are there now in this series?
236,000.
There's gotta be. I mean, I think it's like 9 or 10.
I was gonna say for real, there's gotta be like 8 to 10.
Yeah, so
maybe it's 8. I don't remember. But there are a lot of these movies, and a lot of these directors keep trying to look back. I'm like, well, what made the 1974 movie so interesting?
Right.
And I think that, for one, it was exceptionally low budget, right?
Yeah.
And it was also kind of predicated on this weird kind of tension between, like, the hippie yuppies, right? The ones that show up in the VW van in the 70s, right?
They don't know nothing about the country.
Yeah, they don't know nothing about the country, and they show up, and then there's these...
So they deserve to die.
There's these southern cannibals, right? Which, like, come and like, kill them and eat them, and it's a fucking nightmare.
And because it's so low budget, because it's so grainy and the audio is muffled...
They get away with way more in that movie than anything else. So attempts to revisit this with a bigger and bigger and bigger budget,
right,
I think sometimes misses the mark because it's always something of the politics of the moment. I think this movie in particular sits really poorly with me because of the way that it kind of frames its politics, right? In this movie, it revisits a lot of the same ideas of the original Texas Chainsaw. The main characters are like college age kids with a lot of money who are coming to this podunk town in Nowheresville, Texas, where they've purchased all of the land, all of the buildings, and they've got a bunch of hipsters who are coming in to, what's that word when you have hipsters come in and move into?
Oh,
gentrify.
Gentrify. Yeah.
They're coming in to gentrify this area of Texas.
Big mistake.
And they are a diverse group of kids. You know, there's like...
Oh, no, not in Texas. No, exactly. You're going to pay for that.
There's like the whole story kicks off because they show up. There's already this weird kind of like semi-racist... But like a thin blue line bro who shows up in his like gas guzzling giant Texas truck.
Yeah.
And he's their landscaper or whatever. He's their the guy who's been fixing up all of these buildings for sale to these hipster investors.
Gotcha.
Right. And so the group of hipsters show up in this town. And one of them, who's trying to show like, hey, don't you want to buy a stake in this town and help us gentrify it? He spots an old Confederate flag on a building and he says, oh, no, you can't fly that shit. And like, that's his original sin, right? He's like, he looks at the rich Southern history of Texas and is like, oh no, racism. And he charges into this abandoned orphanage or whatever, where he encounters this old lady who is like, no, but I bought the deed to the house. Like, you don't own this house. This is my property. And he doesn't believe her because, of course, he bought all the property, right?
Right.
And so he's trying to take down the Confederate flag, and he's not able to. And it really pisses this woman off. She has, like, a heart attack and dies. And her son, I don't know what the relationship is. I think it's her son. Her son's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre guy.
Oh. So he Leatherface.
Leatherface. Yeah. So he cuts her face off after a trip.
Because of course.
Right. The police are trying to drive her off to a hospital or whatever. He cuts her face off because she meant something to him. And then he indiscriminately slaughters every fucking yuppie in this movie.
Right. Yeah.
Except for the one kid. The final girl of this movie is a girl who is also a final girl from her school shooting massacre.
Ah. Oh, and they, this okay. All right. It makes sense that Rotten Tomatoes gave it 31%.
What I'm saying, so this what is... I'm laying down is that this movie is quite possibly one of the worst fucking movies I've seen in this franchise, from the way that it seems to glorify the violence against a quote-unquote woke generation.
Right, like, what's the lesson? You're going to come in here and try to...
So this is a conservative...
Leave Texas alone.
This is
Texas
a MAGA's wet dream.
Yeah, a MAGA wet dream. Yeah, if you come here with your hippie shit, we'll murder you.
And if there was any hint...
Is that the lesson?
If there was any hint of irony in this whole fucking movie, right, that wanted to suggest at least a little bit, like... you know, I don't know. Maybe we shouldn't be murdering hipsters trying to gentrify towns that nobody fucking lives in Texas anyway.
Right.
Like, maybe we should be embracing a culture of diversity and look at what we can accomplish together. If there was any hint of irony at all that the reading was not like, let's just murder fucking kids. I don't know. Like, maybe it would be a better movie.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. And
it sounds
so,
like it's kind of all over the place.
It is so gleeful in how it murders these like Gen Zers or whatever.
Yeah.
These millennials. I guess they're more millennials. Yeah,
when the whole thing started, like in the 70s, it seemed like the goal was just to be shocking, was just to make something
in
that's
a way.
Completely horrifying. I mean, because there are no redeeming characters in the movie.
Yeah, and I mean, it also kind of serves a little bit as a commentary, if you will, on the growing divide between rural and urban spaces in the United States.
Right.
And I think that this movie, especially in this moment, could have done the same thing. It could have had an interesting commentary. And it definitely sets up that same dichotomy, right?
Yeah.
But I think that in the end of the movie, it feels like it takes a real perverse glee in slaughtering indiscriminately the people who in this story are looking to create a kind of good change. I'm not saying that the characters, you know, these millennials or whatever, are necessarily good people, because they have selfish motivations, and there are, especially like when it comes to the one character, you know, he's so invested in making his money from this rural space that he cuts corners that actually do impact people's lives.
Yeah,
but it's also like,
but it's like unwittingly,
right? It's also kind of like, do we really have a whole lot of, should we have sympathy for the people who are maybe displaced by this you know, gentrification or this like revitalization of some of these spaces when those people are fucking racist maniacs?
I was going to say, they're murderers. Who gives a shit?
I don't know. Yeah, I just...
How can you take their side on anything if they're murderers?
It sits poorly with me that the whole... It's like, oh, this situation could have been avoided if we had just had some empathy. Because it's just arming this weird, radical, white, right-wing nut job to get a chainsaw and murder people on a party bus.
Yikes.
Yeah, I don't know.
It just sounds like a hard
thing.
It feels
very one-dimensional. Like,
yeah, I did not enjoy it.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
that's the vibe I got from all those movies. It's one-dimensional. It's just slaughter.
If you're just going for the wholesale slaughter, like, let me tell you, holy shit, is there a lot of blood.
It delivers,
and guts.
Right? But all those story elements,
but the
though,
rest,
those seem really odd.
Like, after the movie was over, I was like, holy shit, that's a fucking wild movie. And some of it, I mean, like, a part of it is fun because you don't go to watch a Texas Chainsaw movie and not see some people get murdered by a chainsaw from Texas. But also, you know, at the end of the day, I was just like, man, I don't know what it is about this movie that is just so deeply unpalatable to me.
There's real hatred in the world, and there's no reason to stoke that type of cultural bullshit.
You stumbled onto something, though, and I would like to ask you this. Is the chainsaw from Texas?
Well, yeah, I mean...
Is it a Texas chainsaw?
I don't
chainsaw?
Know.
Was it made in Texas and then used? Or is it just...
Here's what's hilarious about this dumb fucking movie. You ready?
Chinese
when
chainsaw.
When he goes to retrieve his chainsaw,
it's electric.
He apparently...
the cord's too short. Yeah. It unplugs while he's running.
He's like...
oh, shit!
no, he apparently, because this is the same guy who murdered all those people in the 70s, right?
He's really old now.
Yeah. Well, that's another
seriously.
Thing. He's like,
can he even start that thing anymore?
He's super old and yet immortal, right?
Like a Mike Myers.
He goes to retrieve his chainsaw because obviously it's chainsaw time. And, and his chainsaw is buried in the wall, like of this orphanage. They like put the chainsaw in the wall and then like you know, papered the like put the drywall up and then papered the wall and stuff to hide it. And so when it's chainsaw time, he like has to get like an axe or something and he like chops through the wall and you're like, what is he doing? Because he's in a bedroom and like one of the characters is trapped under the bed that he's like blasting the drywall down on. And then he pulls out his chainsaw, and I'm like, of course he was...
It's just supposed to be the moment where you go, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because you're like, what's he getting?
What's
he
getting?
His chainsaw!
Oh, shit!
It's so fucking stupid.
Yeah.
He's got an axe. He's got an axe, and he uses the axe to get the chainsaw.
To get the chainsaw. Because you can't have a Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
What if he doesn't have, like... What if he didn't have like the right mix of oil and gas?
Saying,
like
he needs the theatrics.
Well, and that's another thing. Has this chainsaw been in that fucking wall for 40 or 50 fucking years? 50 years?
Oh my god!
This chainsaw was in the wall for 50 fucking years, and it still just starts like, and it's just fucking ready to go,
it's
ready
like
to
an
chop
evil
people
chainsaw.
In half.
It doesn't need gas. It just lives on hatred.
I mean,
so dumb.
If I were ever,
that is really dumb.
I'd love to see like a short of one of those movies where the dude goes to all that trouble to get the chainsaw and somebody walks up with a 12 gauge and just shoots him in the head.
Seriously,
well, no,
yeah,
but that's
like,
another thing.
Those real
that's
life
another
moments
thing because just... like a Texas Ranger, that the final girl from the 70s movie shows up as a recurring character, not played by the same actress, but the same character shows up. She's a Texas Ranger now and she comes in with a fucking shotgun and she's got him like dead to rights. And she's like, can you just tell me why you killed all my friends? And he says nothing because, of course, he's a fucking sociopath murderer. And she just lets him go. She doesn't shoot him. And then later on, she tries to shoot him. And she's the worst shot of any Texas Ranger I've ever
oh
fucking seen.
So she's like the Jamie Lee Curtis of this movie. Like, you
if
know, Janie, that Laurie Strode.
If Jamie Lee Curtis was like an actual pussy. Like, just,
she was badass in that film.
She was badass in that film. And I say that not to be like gender discriminating. I'm just saying, like, come the fuck on. You're the worst Texas Ranger I have ever seen in any media.
Yeah.
And we have watched Walker.
And we have watched Walker. This is including not just Walker Texas Ranger, the first one.
You remember the song?
But the CW
the
Texas
Eyes of the Ranger.
Ranger.
The eyes of the Ranger are upon you. Everything you do, he's going to see.
Man,
it's like he's law enforcement. Like, you know, he's not supposed to be like omnipotent.
Right.
Just Propaganda.
It's
bullshit.
Just,
anyway.
Anyway.
That's a different podcast.
We now that we've spent 30 fucking minutes on Texas
That was
Chainsaw.
Way too long. So
I hate that movie. So, Uncharted with Tom Holland, Mark Wahlberg.
Never watched it. Did not watch it. Mark Wahlberg.
Marky Mark.
Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch.
Yeah. Mark, Tom Holland and Marky Mark.
I mean, this Rotten Tomatoes gave this a 40%.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say, if you are a fan of like National Treasure style adventure movies, this one hits the mark.
Is this based on the video game?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. I love the games.
I'm not going to say that it's as good as the games, because the games are way better, honestly.
That's not usually the case.
Yeah. No. I think because video game movies are really hard to make. Because
no, I'm really conflicted about watching Sonic the Hedgehog.
Mortal Kombat was the biggest piece of shit of all time, because they didn't do any of the gore. So it's hard to do a movie about a video game.
I will see your Mortal Kombat, sir, and I will raise you a Street Fighter.
Ooh, good
Street
point.
Fighter is such an... It's so weird how that movie is both watchable and completely unforgivable.
And Mortal Kombat is unwatchable and unforgivable.
Okay, I feel the opposite. Dude, I feel like... Okay,
which
Mortal Kombat are we talking about?
The very first Mortal Kombat movie.
The 90s one?
Yes.
That movie is fucking gold, and I will fight you over it.
Oh, not a drop of blood. When you're my age and you're playing the game and Sub-Zero pulls out someone's spine.
Sure.
And then the movie's coming out and you're like, I get to see spine ripping in graphic detail. And then they didn't do a fucking second of any of that. I was like, oh, God. I felt so ripped off. You could watch that shit in front of your parents.
I think
it's dope. I love that. Christopher Lambert, well, he's like running around as Raiden.
Laugh. What's up with Raiden's voice?
His laugh. He's like,
Fair enough. But what about Super Mario Brothers?
Unwashable.
With Dennis Hopper and John Leguizamo.
He's my favorite. And the guy that played Smee on Hook.
He
was Mario.
Yeah.
What was his name?
Bob Hoskins.
That movie is awesome. Fucking wild.
I know a photographer from Dallas who looks exactly like Bob Hoskins.
Uncharted as a movie, like, I don't know.
That was what we were talking about.
Yeah. I feel Uncharted. Like the Uncharted movies or the Uncharted games are like, it's like a gourmet hamburger, and like Uncharted the movie is like going to McDonald's for one.
Okay. That's
like,
a bummer.
I mean, it's still a burger. Right? And like, there are gonna be aficionados of that burger. I don't think that there's anything necessarily wrong with a McDonald's burger. It's not the best burger you're gonna have,
but
it's recognizably a burger, right?
So does that make Mark Wahlberg the special vegan sauce burger?
It's edible and you'll be fine. After consumption, you'll probably be okay.
Is Marky Mark the special sauce?
I just picture him making that face the whole time.
Honestly, Marky
Mark... Did he do the confused eyebrows the whole movie? What the fuck?
Straight up, I think Marky Mark is a delight to watch in almost every movie. I think he's great.
Except that 21 Blocks. Okay, I don't think we enjoyed that.
Mile 22
or whatever that was called,
That movie's bad, but I don't think that
it's not Marky Mark.
Marky Mark's problem. Like, that's just the director doesn't know how to make a fucking
And he's
movie.
Been making movies for, like, forever.
Yeah.
The Big Hit was my favorite Mark Wahlberg movie.
I'm telling you, I love...
1998. It was such a good year for movies.
I love his weird, confused, whiny voice. So funny. Yeah.
I enjoyed Ted and Ted too.
I'm Mark Wahlberg.
Why did you
confused.
Put the gun in the safe?
I'm always kind of whispering when I talk a little bit.
Yeah. He's a lot of fun.
So what do we have next?
Death on the Nile. Sorry, let me say that again. Death on the Nile.
That's like the most metal.
Sunday. Death.
I'm sure that's what Agatha Christie meant when she made Death on the Nile.
Death on the Nile.
Well, one of my favorite death metal bands is called Nile, so that just really rung a bell for me. Yeah.
Anyway. I was going to make a joke about Frasier because I'm rewatching the Frasier TV, and his brother's name is Nile.
When it's really, really funny, you shout Death on the Nile with, like, you know, your metal band voice. And then the main characters, Hercule Poirot. He's like a Belgian.
Okay, so it's a little more...
Kenneth Branagh.
A little more suave.
He's directing and starring as Hercule Poirot.
Gal Gadot and Armie Hammer. Yeah.
Gal Gadot. Remember, folks, Gal from Gadot. Our Charles Gal Adams Gadot. Episode that Charles Adams.
You know what? Armie Hammer. I feel like this movie was really competent. It's a murder mystery, so you know what you're getting into when you go in. I think if you've read the book, it has no surprises. Stylistically, you can tell that this movie was shot during COVID. Like, there's a lot of just like the camera spinning around a person
was it
as
filmed
they're
with
monologuing.
A webcam? The whole movie is filmed with a webcam. Is that how you know it was during COVID?
Yeah, basically. it's more like the blocking. You know, like,
zoom the whole thing.
It's like the blocking. You'll see them, like, characters are having a talk with each other, but they're clearly like 8 feet apart.
Right.
And I just think this is so fucking funny. The way that they try to create, like, well, we're going to do something really interesting with this scene. Where, like, you have a monologue, so what we're going to do is we're going to spin the camera around you in a 360, and, like, you just deliver your monologue, but we're constantly spinning around you while you're doing it. And it's like they're just hiding the fact that that dude was in front of a green screen and couldn't stand around other people because of COVID.
You know what they should have done? They should have put green masks on everybody and then animate their mouths moving on top of the green screen mask, right? I would have actually really enjoyed that. They could film their real mouth in the different room and then just display it onto their green.
That'd be whatever.
That's a high level production trick, right?
It's
there.
Like the Superman's mustache thing in the Justice League.
You know, my God.
Because Henry Cavill was filming Mission Impossible and had to come in and do some reshots for the Justice League movie. And he had the mustache for Mission Impossible, and he wasn't going to shave it off. So what they did was they removed his mustache in post. And so you get these shots of Superman where he's, like, grimacing at Batman and shit. And it looks so fucking terrible.
Oh, no. They didn't pull it off?
Because they digitally re-sculpted the entire lower half of his face.
That's insane.
It's bad.
That's insane.
It's bad.
Oh, was it as bad as the next entry on our list?
Which is Moonfall,
okay?
Directed by Roland
Emmerich.
I was gonna say Emmerich. I gotta be honest.
I wish I had come in to the studio as I was watching this movie because my thoughts are so like vast and complex, so much more vast and complex.
We're about to add 30 more minutes
fucking
to this
movie. Yes, we are. This is worth it. Let me tell
38%
you.
38% on Rotten Tomatoes. So I'm.
That's generous.
Oh.
Okay, so Roland Emmerich was the director of Independence Day and
the first one?
Yeah, the first
He's
one.
He's done all those disaster films, hadn't he?
Yeah,
like
2012. He did Day After Tomorrow.
I really, really liked Independence Day I watched it as an adult.
I think that Independence Day was his last good movie.
Oh, that's
it was
good.
Also like his first movie, wasn't it? So
I don't know. I don't think it was his first one.
It may not have been, but
it was
his only
really big hit.
Dude, he blew up the White House and freaked everybody out.
It was fucking wild.
Everybody freaked out when the White House blew up in
that
movie.
That movie is bonkers. So this movie was supposed to be like kind of his return to like a both a really destructive kind of like eco movie, because that's what he's done a lot of previously. You know, like 2012 was like an end of the world movie. He does a lot of these.
Oh, that was him? 2012?
Yeah, he does a lot of these like disaster movies, right?
Right.
But this one was kind of his return to like another big kind of like sci-fi thing. He did that with the Independence Day sequel, but that was kind of a sequel. This is supposed to be its own thing. And the whole premise is like the moon is a superstructure and it's like a space arc, right? Like it has like the DNA of all human race and basically the human race's alien forebears created this superstructure, but the superstructure is infected by a massive AI that's aiming to blow up the moon and then blow up all of Earth because it wants to eradicate human life. Whatever.
Naturally. Yeah. Naturally.
This is the most sensible.
As these things tend to go.
This is the most sensible part of the movie. Let's talk about, how about this? Like, they get into the superstructure of the moon, and the one nerd, the fat nerd, who would never survive in space, let's be real.
Didn't you say he couldn't go? He said he couldn't go initially because he had IBS.
He couldn't go because he has irritable bowel syndrome. And what's his face? Good old
what?
Yeah, good old Patrick Wilson is like. But think about it. Haven't you always wanted to go? And he's like, I have always wanted to go to the moon. And so they talk him out of his IBS. And
fuck it. Yeah. I'll have a tummy ache on the moon.
Yeah. Well, I think what's so upsetting is that like he doesn't shit his pants at any part in the movie, which really would have been the payoff for that joke.
Well, if you're weightless, yeah, I don't want to see a zero gravity pants.
I do. I would rather see that than fucking moonfall. He gets into the superstructure of the moon.
The physics of diarrhea in space. Yeah.
They're looking for the power source of the moon, right? The power source of the moon. And they're like, it's a white dwarf star at the center of the moon. And I'm like,
what?
Yes.
What?
Yes. In the center of the moon, it's powered by a white dwarf star.
A star is coated in powdery rocks.
I just want you to think about this.
Dude, that is insane.
How big is the smallest recorded white dwarf star? Because it's definitely multiple times bigger than the fucking moon.
I'm not an astrophysicist, but my God.
Well, neither is Roland Emmerich.
Oh, yeah. Maybe he should have talked with one.
No, so when they need to get to the moon, right, they like... Oh my God.
Like sounds like we could do a PTSD. Mini episode on this one.
Oh my God.
Halle Berry, who is the director of NASA. Here's how Halle Berry gets her job in this movie, right? She's hanging out with the director of NASA. They find out that the moon is a superstructure. The moon's orbit is changing and it's going to
blow
up.
Oh, I thought you meant how she got the job in the movie. Like, yeah. Like got the role.
Oh, no.
I was like, what?
No, she got the role by being Halle Berry.
Right.
In fact, you know what? I think she got the role based on the strength of her acting career in, like, specifically Catwoman. Like, that's...
Oh, yeah.
She brings the same energy to this
movie. I was thinking the first X-Men when it's like, do you know what happens to a toad when it gets struck by lightning?
Yeah. At least that line was good.
I can imagine. What?
I mean, the answer is same thing as everything else.
Pop? Yeah. Yeah. So at least she didn't bring that monster's ball energy to this movie.
Yeah. So Halle Berry's hanging out with the director of NASA, and they discover, like, that the moon's orbit is changing. So the director of NASA, as they're discovering that the Earth is doomed, right, picks up his phone, calls his wife and says, pack your bags, we're leaving. And I'm like, to fucking where?
We're leaving.
Where are you gonna go that you're gonna survive
Titan's
a fucking
nice this
moon crash?
Titan's nice this time of year.
I'm just sitting in disbelief. He's like, pack your bag. Where are you? We're talking about an extinction level event and you're just like, we're going to Hawaii.
Yeah, we're going to have some beach fun.
Yeah, what are you expecting?
For our last few days. So where were they going?
So who knows?
It
doesn't say. So the director of NASA is like, I'm heading out of town. Like, fuck this job. Here, you're now Halle Berry. You're the director of NASA. So she just ends up the director of NASA.
Totally how that works, I'm sure.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Obviously. So she like puts together this mission. They're going to launch a rocket up to the moon because they got to get a space shuttle to the moon in order to keep the moon from blowing up. She gets a bunch of people, like thousands of people working for NASA, and they start cobbling together this fucking rocket to send this fucking shuttle to the moon. And a moonquake happens, and
I fucking hate moonquakes.
Yeah,
I
fucking moonquakes, right? And it fucks up one of the rockets, and they blow out.
I really
out
don't
an
like
engine.
The moon aftershocks.
Seriously,
really get this, bad.
Is there any seismic activity on the moon?
No.
The
moon's allegedly the moon's gravity fucks with Earth gravity because it gets too close and then it like creates a moonquake.
Yeah. Oh, the moonquake.
Yeah. Yeah, so the moon's gravitational pull fucks up like Earth gravity and then Earth gravity's tectonics like fuck up whatever.
This it all breaks, sounds really made up on
it,
the spot.
Of yeah. course. It breaks one of the engines for the ship. And so like Halle Berry's like, well, I guess we gotta scrub the launch. Sorry guys, we've had a good run. So she sends everybody home, and within literally 2 minutes, fucking every NASA person has left. And they're like, well, we still gotta get to the moon. And one of the fat
IBS guy. It's like, well, like what we can do is we only need the one rocket, right? Let's just, we only need the one engine. We'll just fire our rocket up and we'll use the moon's gravity to pull us the rest of the way. And she's like, that's just fucking crazy enough to work. And she's like, but
you're like, but smart.
But we can't do it. I just sent home the entire launch crew. And Patrick Wilson is like, we only need two people. All you need is, we just got to push the button to launch.
It's so easy.
Why do we have NASA? That's what I'm saying. Because it only takes two fucking people.
Oh my God, dude.
She goes looking for secrets of the moon because she's like, she's been kept out of like the top secret.
There's
mission.
A movie title.
Secrets of the moon. She's been kept moon. Out of like the top secret information that the moon is a fucking artificial construct, right? Never mind the fact that at the beginning of the movie, Patrick Wilson sees the fucking AI like bullshit, the nanobite bullshit that comes out of the moon, and he's there with Halle Berry, and Halle Berry isn't privy to any of the fucking mission information. So anyway, she gets her clearance from NASA.
She's
as
one
the
of the two
of
people.
NASA.
How does she not know?
I don't know. Exactly.
She's part so of a NASA
gets,
duo.
She gets the clearance to go find this information from NASA. She goes into the NASA secret files. She finds a grainy VHS tape. Mind you, we're talking about a VHS tape that was somehow recorded from digital, like virtual streaming from the moon mission that she was just recently on. Why? Why is that information on a grainy VHS tape? You're telling me that someone has like a VHS tape to record the stuff that you would just put on a fucking thumb drive? Okay.
Odd choice.
It's so stupid.
I'm telling you, it's because they can pull the tab on the VHS tape and put the tape over, like the scotch tape over it, and you can't record over it.
That's right. That's right.
So she's reviewing the VHS tape for like the secret information of the moon. And then I think it's Donald Sutherland. He shows up and he's like, what are you doing in here? And she's like looking at secret moon information. And he's like, this is top secret. You can't look at this information. And she's like, tell me about the moon. And he's like, okay, I'll tell you everything I know about the moon. I was like, you just came in here because of a security concern, because you were like, you can't know this information. And she asks you one fucking question and then you're like, yeah, I'll spill it.
All right.
I'm pretty positive.
Falling. I got nothing else going on.
I'm pretty positive that when I've heard the same story pitched to me when I've gone and told people like, hey, I'm an author, I'm a writer or something. And you get like these people who want to be writers, but they've never like gotten into it officially.
So what you're hearing
And they come up and they're like, ooh, I have a great idea for a story. See? And they're like an eight-year-old like telling you this idea. And
that's this movie.
That's who wrote this.
Hopelessly full of holes and inconsistencies and all that. Yeah.
Nobody.
Somebody went up to Roland Emmerich. Went up to Roland Emmerich and said that, like pitched this, and he's like, "It's so crazy, it might work."
I hope they said
Roland
that in
Roland Emmerich,
movie.
Like, yeah, whoever
has he ever
this?
Had a like turned down an idea?
Like, I feel like okay, like I know I rely pretty heavily on the joke of like how much cocaine was in that room.
Oh, dude, I mean.
Did they spend their $146 million budget on cocaine?
Cocaine!
Was
sorry, every time you say cocaine.
Legitimately, cocaine. I just can't wrap my head around what a fucking boondoggle this movie
this
is.
This guy has like some, what's the other director that's goofy? Transformers. Michael Bay.
Yeah.
Does he have like some Michael Bay vibes about him?
There is some real Michael Bay energy in here.
Right.
Yeah.
Roland Emmerich and Michael Bay are playing this game of yes and, or this game of like, hold my beer. Like, I'm making this movie. Oh, yeah. Well, hold my beer. Watch what I do.
Yeah.
There are subplots of this movie that I'm like, what the fuck is happening here? I think like Land Rover or whatever the fuck must have paid him a whole bunch of movie to be like, make sure you have a solid 40-minute B-plot.
So that's what these movies are kind of about, really.
Oh,
product
yeah,
placement?
Yeah, product placement, for sure.
Yeah. Lots of really exciting visuals, and then
in a movie called
a
Moonfall, I really want you to dig into the pathos of the characters that are left in fucking Colorado as the moon is falling. Don't show us the fucking whatever white dwarf star in the middle, of, which doesn't make any fucking sense. Don't show us any of that.
I don't even know
explain any of the lore of your stupid movie. Just exposit it to us in a 12-minute dialogue, in the fucking last act of the movie.
Their whole thing is like, who cares? It's a movie. Like, if you ask any questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like, how does a star fit in the... Who cares? It's a movie.
Yeah, it's a movie.
I can't stand when people say that. Who cares? It's a movie.
Yeah.
Like, movies are supposed to make you feel stuff because they're based in some little bit of reality.
This movie had me laughing aloud the entire fucking runtime. I was cackling like a maniac. And it's not because this movie is good. It's because with every choice... they made the worst fucking choice possible for telling this story.
I don't think I've ever liked a Halle Berry movie. I mean, what movie?
Okay.
Her big movies were like Swordfish.
She did like Gothica. And she won an award for Gothica.
I like the James Bond movie, but then she was in a bikini for that one. So
I was going to say, every time she's in a movie that I liked, she was kind of being sexualized, which is... basically distracting from what's going on in the movie.
Straight up, I do not think she's a good actor.
No! Yeah. Thank you! Yeah. I'm like afraid to say it. I'm like waiting on somebody else to say it.
No, I
everybody
think
loves Halle Berry.
I think she's a terrible actor.
It's shitty. Yeah. It's real shitty. Monsters Ball just was... oh my god!
I never watched that, but that made me... like, I'm not a
Her
fan of that kind
was
of...
was like, what?
Yeah.
Dude, too much!
I will never forget the infamous... basketball sequence of Catwoman.
Oh god! See, I'm not gonna watch it, like, because I'm done. I've been done with Halle Berry since like the early 2000s.
Okay, that Catwoman movie. Well, I mean, Catwoman was a mess because Halle Berry is legitimately terrible,
right?
But also because like the editors of that movie is like ungodly. It's fucking crazy.
Cloud Atlas. It's not good because of Halle Berry, but I was actually able to enjoy that movie despite the fact she was in it. So that's something.
The one thing I will say about Halle Berry is that she received a Razzie, I think, for her performance of Catwoman. And I'm pretty sure she showed up in person to receive it and then, like, went full tilt, like, just... I can't remember if it was like she was playing along or... what? I mean, she had a legendary performance at the Razzies one year.
Oh, man.
Where she was, I mean, she actually showed up to accept the, because nobody shows up to accept a Razzie.
No.
She did. And she did it as part of this performance of like, yeah, well, you know what? I'm going to own the fact that, you know, this is a shitty movie.
And I'm guessing it didn't really land that, you know, like.
No, people really appreciated it.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I visualize like that being a really cringy moment because she makes me cringe a lot.
Well, I mean, it is, but I mean,
like, you know, when some people try self-deprecation, but they're kind of just like,
yeah, you don't get a Razzie without being like incredibly cringy.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you kind of got it. I mean, the Razzies themselves are pretty cringe.
I'm waiting for our Razzie for the podcast.
Yeah, if I had to, if I had to create a list of people to get Razzies, I think Halle Berry definitely
earned it. All right, enough.
Cool
about
guys.
Moonfall.
Enough of Halle Berry. So
we got
a few more movies to check out here. So.
Okay, you want to talk about a bad movie?
Was it Gucci or Nah?
It was not Gucci. House of House of Gucci.
There's a back of the paper.
There's a page two.
I was like, oh shit!
You were packing up.
I was like, guys,
we're done. Nope, we're just getting started.
House of Gucci.
We did it.
House of Gucci, directed by Ridley Scott, starring Lady Gaga, Adam Driver, Al Pacino, Jeremy Irons, and Mr. Mario himself, Jared Leto.
Jared Leto's in this movie.
Yeah,
I forgot to put his name on.
He plays one of the Gucci like cousins or whatever.
So you're saying it was not Gucci?
It is not.
Nah.
You said Mr. Mario. What does that mean?
So Jared Leto. Okay, let me preface. Every single one of these actors in this movie has an Italian accent.
Oh, no way. I know where you're going with this now.
What's hilarious is that, number one, I don't think Ridley Scott hired anything approaching any kind of accent coach for any of these actors. Not a single one of them. It's hilarious because you listen to them and they have a conversation and you're like, which region of Italy is Lady Gaga from? Which region of Italy is Adam Driver supposed to be from? Like, right. They're speaking in an Italian accent that sounds like someone who doesn't know what an Italian accent like sounds like.
It's like it's like a Chef Boyardee commercial.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
It's a good.
No, he's exactly nice. Right. So like Lady Gaga is doing what I can only imagine must be like an accent from Italy placed in New Jersey.
Right.
And then
right.
we get to Jared Leto.
She's from like New York or New Jersey, isn't she?
Yeah.
She probably just turned on
I'm
her.
I'm assuming she did better than anybody with the Italian.
I think it was Al Pacino would probably do pretty good.
Al Pacino just sounds like a fucking.
Hey, yo, I'm Al Pacino.
He sounds like a fucking like New Yorker Italian.
So did they all kind of phone in the accent?
No, I mean, like, who did Lady Gaga really, really tried, but her accent is also really inconsistent. Adam Driver does the most inconsistent. like accent, like you can tell he's really trying, but also like, come on. But then we get to Jared Leto, and Jared Leto is like, "It's a me."
I was waiting for you to say that.
I make Italian suits.
Oh, it's a me.
It's a me.
The Joker.
Listen, do you have some money for the suits?
Oh my God, it's a me. Everyone's least favorite Joker.
I am not joking. I am not exaggerating that. That is genuinely how he comes in to every single one of the roles.
Mamma mia!
Yeah, like every scene he shows up, I'm like, what fucking clown car did this guy come out of?
Jared Leto?
How did
Razzie.
Ridley... But how?
Razzie, oh, yes.
He's gonna win that.
Max
Razzie.
Raz.
I just am like, how did Ridley Scott, like acclaimed director Ridley Scott, sit down, make this movie, and when Jared Leto comes out and he's like, "I'm gonna make us a suit," I spilled the meatball on my pants.
Oh no!
Oh no! And what Ridley Scott is like, "More."
Yes.
More.
A star is being born.
Dig into this, Jared Leto. Yes.
Dude, the fact that anybody thought
it's a dwarf star, but it's being born nonetheless. We're going to put it in the moon.
Roland
Emmerich, I have an idea for you.
Knowing Jared Leto, too, and his like stupid, like, I only am ever in character, like his stupid method
so
acting,
dumb.
Whatever.
So dumb.
I can only imagine that he comes home from work and his girlfriend or his wife or whatever is like, "How'd it go?" And he's like, "It was really a hard day."
What do you want for dinner tonight, honey?
I want the spaghetti. Like a mama used to make.
Make it the sauce. And when you make it the sauce, really make it the sauce.
Oh, I want the tomato.
We're being just awful.
But that's the joke.
But that's the whole
joke.
Thing. That's
the
what
joke
he's doing.
The joke isn't stereotyping Italian people. The joke is stereotyping Jared Leto.
He sucks.
Actively stereotyping Italian people.
Dude,
fucking unreal.
I didn't watch the Joker movie with him, but I watched somebody review it and point out how bad it was.
Oh.
And all these facts about him, like, doing weird stuff on set, putting dead rats in people's trailers.
Sending
and
people
stuff,
used
because he's the Joker, and that's what he does.
Insufferable.
None of it landed with anybody. They were just disturbed. Yeah, he seems like a real weird.
Yeah.
Fucking
so this movie, if you want to watch anything about like House of Gucci, you go to watch it just to fucking laugh at how this movie, how utterly batshit this movie ends up being because of the creative choices.
I will not watch it now that I know Jared Leto's in it.
Yeah, I won't either.
Nope. It's unreal.
What Encanto. About? Yeah, this feels like it's going totally different direction as
I
far as.
I loved this one.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Dude, 91% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, because really this good. Is a good fucking movie. It's, you know, it's like a movie about a generation of people who live in this magical house and they get magical powers. It's a Disney movie.
Right.
And but it's really, I think it's more a movie about trying to live up to the expectations of the generation that came before you.
Right. Preserving the pressure of preserving tradition.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And like trying to find yourself and your sense of identity.
Mm-hmm.
And still try to like be your authentic self when so many people want something from you, right, or expect right. something from you.
Which works in so many social arenas, yeah. that type of framing.
So it's yeah. an absolutely beautiful movie. Everybody is talking about the song, the Bruno song, We Don't Talk About Bruno, which I think has become...
Bruno?
Yeah, there's a character, Bruno.
Oh, I was like, Bruno Mars did a song for the movie?
No. It's the character... character named Bruno, and nobody talks about him. And so there's a song like, We Don't Talk About Bruno, which has actually kind of been co-opted by, I think, the LGBTQ community about, you know, the fact that so many of their family abandon them for their identity, you know, for right. the things they can't change about themselves.
Yeah.
And this character, Bruno, like, tells the future, right? That's kind of his thing. And people misunderstand him because of that, and they cast him as a villain that he really is not. And so I think that's been used as a metaphor. For me, I think the banger of the movie is this song that one of the sisters sings about the weight and the pressure of...
Sing it for us.
I can't sing it. but it's like the weight and the pressure of just like having to live up to people's expectations of you.
Yeah.
And I think it's a beautiful movie. It's beautifully animated. I think it's got so much heart, so much to really actually say, which I think is very rare in a lot of animated films.
A lot of these Disney movies that have come out over the past 10 years, I'm just like, man, you know, don't release a movie just because you haven't released one in a year.
Right.
Like, wait till you've got a story that actually means something. And I feel like these movie, stories are
And this
like
one's now on Disney Plus, too.
It is, so yeah.
And yeah, this one stood out to me much more than... God, dude. There's like a list of like eight movies that I just don't care about.
No, yeah.
And they're all visually stunning. They're all masterpieces of like graphic design. And,
yeah.
But... whatever, if the story's not there, it's really hard for me, because Disney, that's what they do. It's the story that matters with Disney movies.
I'm going to take a little bit of a turn in that we've seen so many of these like computer animated kind of films coming out. Like that seems to be the new animation. I want to see like the old school like cartoon.
Hand-drawn. I think the last time they did one was like Hercules, Pocahontas.
I think it was actually Lilo and Stitch.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
It was like the late 90s.
Right.
Yeah. You know what? Maybe that's not true. Maybe it was Princess and the Frog.
Maybe.
But I can't remember if that was digitally animated or if it was like actually hand painted or hand animated.
I mean, I don't think they've done a hand cartoon mm-hmm. since like, man, a really long time, like before Lion King, right? No, I mean, they were doing computer. Maybe.
I mean, even then, though, it still had that animation kind of style, and it was
2D.
It was 2D.
But they still, for a large part,
and it was really interesting. Like when Toy Story first came out, and they did this kind of new thing, but now it's like everybody does it. It's like I want to go back to the 2D kind of
right.
I would like to see more handcrafted animation.
Yeah,
yeah,
I really would
take the time, spend the money on it to have like a team of real artists.
Yeah,
and don't
I think
get me
the,
wrong.
The result would be. Crazy.
Don't get me wrong. I watch something like Encanto and I'm like, this is absolutely visually stunning. It is a visual feast. I absolutely love it. But I also do miss some of that, just the kind of painterly quality of a hand animated film.
And I do, you know, 3D animation stuff too. And,
right.
and I know that they are recycling a lot of things.
Yeah.
Because that's what you do.
Yeah.
Right. If you've got something saved, you've got like sparkles that come out of a jar or something.
Yeah.
You can use those same sparkles in the next movie because why wouldn't you?
Right.
It's right there in a file.
Yeah.
Drag and drop. That's how that kind of goes.
Yeah.
You wouldn't spend the time to reanimate each thing. A lot of it gets, but the end result of that is you feel like you're watching the same freaking movie over and over and over. So.
Yeah.
So the next movie that we saw was The King's Man.
We had never seen any of the movies in this series until we watched The King's Man.
All The King's Man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a fun movie.
Ralph. I thought it was really entertaining.
He yelled at me for mispronouncing this, remember?
Ray Fiennes.
Ray?
Ray. Yeah. Ray. It's like,
See, I've heard the name Ray Fiennes. I didn't read it like that. What?
Yeah.
No, this says Ralph.
But that's...
Ralph Fiennes. It says Ralph Fiennes.
Ralph Fiennes.
Not how it's said.
Okay. He's just being obtuse about his name.
I know.
No, it's Ray. Like, yeah. Good luck with that.
Yeah, he's Gemma.
He's trolling me.
Is it Gemma or Gemma?
I thought it was Adderton. Gemma Adderton, yeah, but Gemma. I mean, I also said Ralph Fiennes. And then, what do I know?
Rhys Ifans?
Rhys Ifans?
He plays Rasputin.
Can I say one of the names on this list?
Try for the next one. Try for the next one.
Aaron Taylor Johnson.
Actually, right,
that sounds
Joe,
like an
Joe
actor
Smith?
From Home Improvement, doesn't it?
That's actually Joe Smith.
Aaron Taylor. Yeah, pronounced Joe Smith.
Aaron Taylor Johnson was the guy who played Quicksilver in the
MCU movies.
Yeah, the MCU movie. He was in like Godzilla or something like that. He's been in a couple of movies.
Quicksilver.
This movie is an action movie. It's about a spy agency, I guess, in like a comic book sense. It's actually based on a comic book.
Yeah.
It's about.
The action pieces were fun.
The action sets were really great. The problem that I have with a movie like this is like all of the good stuff is just shown to you in the trailers.
Yeah.
So you go and you watch the movie and it's like there aren't really very many surprises.
I hate it when that happens.
Spoiler free, there was that twist that you and I didn't see coming.
There was one twist that we didn't see coming.
Yeah.
For sure.
Powered by M. Night Shyamalan.
What's funny though?
Did they bring him on board just for the twist?
Rhys Ifans plays Rasputin, and he does this fun, like when he gets into a combat scene, he does this. It's like almost like Russian ballet dancing.
It's a ballet, yeah.
But he's like doing it as like fight move, and so he's like doing these flips and kicks and stuff. And
please
it's
tell
like
tell me music plays when he's doing it.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Naturally. In fact,
like an old opera
or
something.
I think it's like one of the great Russian pieces of classical music.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, cool.
It's like a Russian ballet, and so they're all fighting. Like sword fighting, and he's like twirl kicking, and it's great.
It's
it
like
really
Russian capoeira.
I think
right?
that the action sequences of this are really, really quite cool. But I also think like it's also just a huge dorky stupid.
Yeah, yeah. Rotten Tomatoes gave it 51%. So
I think that's,
they erred on the side of it's a good movie.
I feel like 51% is just like one out of two critics was like yeah all right. I don't know.
I mean, it did make me want to watch the rest of the series.
Yeah, I would give it a solid C.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you've got nothing better to do for an afternoon, why not?
Why not?
But how about Marry Me? It's funny we included this on the list
and
nobody
of us went to see it.
No, I even have Peacock. Like I have the subscription and I'm not watching Marry Me.
I will not watch a Jennifer Lopez movie. I watched Anaconda and I'm done.
I went to see this movie.
I'll watch Jennifer Lopez.
I went to see this movie 3 or 4 times. I bought a ticket. Yeah, because I get the tickets through the AMC Plus.
Oh,
or
I was like,
yeah,
come again.
So it doesn't cost me any money to get a ticket, right? It
doesn't cost you any extra money.
Extra money.
Right. You did pay to see it.
I did pay. It just
which
know,
may be a transgression
money.
On its own. In my book.
So I booked a ticket to see this movie 4 different times. And I'm not joking, every single
time.
It's
that guy again.
Every single time I booked a ticket, something would come up that was just a minor inconvenience.
You folks at home can't see, but Trevor actually has these big, thick plastic glasses, and he walks in with like this look on his face, and he pushes the glasses up. I'm here to theme Jennifer Lopez.
I would like to see the J-Lo movie again.
One for Marry Me?
Yeah. It's the Marry Me guy.
It's the Marry Me.
Hey, it's the Marry Me guy again.
Betty's not married.
Married to J-Lo. I wish I was Owen Wilson in this movie.
I'm going to be married by the end of the movie.
No, but it's like Lopez. Every time there was a minor inconvenience, I was like, well, I can't go see Marry Me now.
Damn it. It's
damn.
Like a little part of you is like,
Yeah. So I still
Kate's
haven't
probably
seen it.
Like, honey, I think this could wait, but we need to go get some Snickers
what's
at
actually...
the store. It's, oh, well, all right. I just can't go see Marry Me then.
Can't go see it. No, it was really funny because I even asked Caitlin. I was like, Kate, do you want to go see this the J-Lo movie with me? And she looked at me and she goes, you actually want to see a J-Lo movie? And I said, I mean, it's not like I wouldn't see it. I'll go see it. And
it's for research.
She looked at
it's
me
for the
and
podcast.
She says, Trevor, that movie is gonna be garbage. So even my
great instincts.
My wife would not go see this movie.
Oh,
man.
I'm just saying. whatever that means.
J-Lo fired somebody from a set of a movie for bringing up the South Park episode with her in it. I think they were singing the Taco 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 Burrito, which is incredibly stupid.
Yeah.
That's not me, everyone. Okay, yeah. I'm quoting South Park, but she is incensed by that. She has never gotten over it. That was 15 years ago.
If we can go on a dumb tangent, right? There's like this group of ladies on the internet on Reddit. There's a subreddit called Female Dating Strategy. And I actually think that the idea behind it is really wholesome. The idea is that like women need to be more comfortable admitting that they have value in a relationship. And they shouldn't settle for douchebags, right?
Agreed.
Yeah. So what the whole idea is like own the fact that you are worthy and that you deserve a partner who can see that worthiness.
Right.
The problem is that it has been co-opted by these fucking crazy people who now are like, if he doesn't have $1 billion and a dick as long as a fucking, I don't know, a longboard, you know, then like, don't date that guy. It's become like this weird toxic community where they're like, there are no good men left in the world. All men are trash. You're a queen, and fucking treat him like dirt because
like a grievances group, right?
Yeah. But not just a grievances group, like a group that is like really militant about like no, they're losers and you should only exist to like siphon their money away. It's real bizarre. They are really...
That's nightmarish.
They've been co-opted.
I'm so glad I don't have to date anymore.
Yeah, they've been co-opted by this group of individuals who are basically like... It's like the incels, right? Who are like, women only exist for my pleasure. Which I think is fucking toxic as shit.
Oh, yeah.
So I get the sense that J-Lo is like... one of those female dating strategy queens. Like, she just refuses to settle down for whatever, like, minor inconvenience that she sees in a guy. And she's like, no, I'm fucking J-Lo.
Yeah,
I have no evidence for this whatsoever.
He eats ketchup.
J-Lo's going to listen. J-Lo and her fans are going to listen to this, and they're going to get real mad at me. But
we should tag them in the...
J-Lo and her fans.
Now, oh gosh, Trevor. Wait, what are we going to talk about next, Trevor?
We saw a movie.
Oh, Lord. Oh, goodness.
It's a movie. People from Wisconsin have don't now abandoned know? Us as well.
Don't you know it's a movie?
Don't you know it's a movie?
Oh, I just love movies.
Oh, Jeremy and Trevor.
We saw The Eyes of Tammy Faye.
Yeah. The Eyes of Tammy Faye.
Tammy Faye Baker.
Starring Jessica Chastain and Andrew Garfield. Oh, that's hard to do for a while.
Yeah, it really is. My voice hurts. I'm afraid it's going to stick like that.
It's probably annoying too, so I'll stop. Yeah.
They do the northern Wisconsin accent through the whole movie. The same way that I think Jared Leto does his Italian accent.
Okay, no. Let's have this conversation now. Jared Leto meets Jessica Chastain. Oh, gosh. Oh, how you doing there?
I'm doing fine. It's a nice day.
Oh, yeah. It's a day the Lord has made, for sure.
How'd you know I was a Catholic?
Oh, no. The Catholics are demons. No, we're evangelists. Oh, yeah. We preach the prosperity gospel, don't you know?
Oh, we just pissed off the 700 Club.
How prosperous.
I thought we did that when we made fun of Joel Osteen
it's coming.
Last year.
We're at war.
Bill Burr told a joke about Joel Osteen. He said, that guy's so full of shit, he can't even talk with his eyes open. He closes his eyes when he talks because he can't even look at you when he's saying it.
I thought he was just doing a Gilbert Gottfried impression.
Oh, yeah. What the hell? Do you want the kingdom of heaven or not? Oh, man. Yeah, but for real, though.
That's true, don't you know? We gotta all go for the kingdom of heaven.
I don't do that accent. This is the only one.
He's like, and we've gone off the rails, everybody.
He's like, this shit made me a millionaire. I'm never stopping.
I'm falling out of my chair.
Oh, man. Oh, golly. So the prosperity gospel, what a concept. There's so many things you could talk about. You can compartmentalize this movie and go on about several things.
Yeah, this
like
movie
tax
was...
fraud.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Prosperity gospel.
Prostitution.
I mean, this movie television. Is weird. I couldn't figure out, is this supposed to be kind of a dark comedy? Is it like more a biopic? You know, like what is this movie trying to do?
That's what I was wondering.
Because it plays Tammy Faye Baker as a really sympathetic figure.
And
for those of you who don't know who Tammy Faye Baker was, she was part of this, you know, the prosperity gospel kind of crew.
Early days of televangelism.
Yes.
And you just assume
she had a very popular program where, you know, talk program where she talked about a lot of social issues.
Her husband was Jim Baker.
For anyone who doesn't know, Tammy Faye was the one with the mascara running way down her face when she was crying.
Yeah.
Which was often.
That was like spoofed on Saturday Night Live too back
then.
It
was.
And this was because she and her husband, right, both were accused.
Of embezzling from their church.
Embezzling from their church. It was a really big scandal.
Tax fraud, wire fraud.
In this whole universe.
Prostitution.
You know, of like televangelism.
The Jessica Hahn. That's how they caught him, because he was paying off Jessica Hahn because she accused him of raping her.
See, I didn't even know that part. Like, you could sprinkle in any crime and I would believe it.
But like, then she like posed for Playboy right after that.
No, it was a real thing. Yeah.
Weird.
He got caught in that big scandal.
And he used church funds to pay her off, and then they investigated and they realized they had been embezzling from their church.
Yeah.
And everybody knew for so long what he was doing. It's just they needed something to hook him on.
Yeah, I mean, like this stuff, like you talk about Joel Osteen, like that guy still does this stuff today.
I don't
think that there is a Christian.
Jim Baker's, I think, worse than Joel Osteen.
Yeah, I don't think there's Christian media out there that isn't doing this in some way.
This is their shtick. Yeah.
Well, I mean, their audience and their base is shrinking like crazy. You're witnessing this real time like desperation. They're doing outrageous things to get people on board.
Vincent D'Onofrio brings a creepy energy to Jerry Falwell.
Oh yeah,
like that was like
super
because
menacing.
You have to.
Yeah.
I mean, super menacing. If you're gonna play Jerry Falwell, you better get ready to creep somebody out.
If there's any one thing that I think this movie does really like poorly, I honestly think that it tries to make sympathetic figures out of Tammy Faye and Jim Baker.
Oh, out of Jim too?
Yeah. They try to make him, you know, kind of cast him as a guy who, you know, a well-meaning guy who just kind of got caught up in the moment.
Oh, bullshit.
Yeah.
He's out there at this moment doing that shit.
He's still doing it.
He's selling doomsday food buckets. Full of garbage MRE shit. Yep. For $2,500, you can get 20 years worth of food.
Stock your apocalypse basement because, you know.
Seriously.
Because Jesus is coming back and the world's fucking ending.
On behalf of everyone on Earth, fuck Jim Baker.
This is a real thing. So that's the problem that I have with this movie, right? It's like they try to paint these very sympathetic figures. From people that I think are just wolves in sheep's clothing. And when you don't portray them as wolves in sheep's clothing, you know,
this shit continues.
And I'm not saying that maybe there wasn't something good about Tammy Faye and the way that she pushed back against the Christian community, for their treatment of gay people, for example. Like, I do think that she was looking a bit more inclusive than the rest of the church was. But I don't think that makes her any less a wolf, right?
Right.
I don't think that makes her any less a predatory
Well, they hint at that too sometimes in the thing. Like, she was a master, like the Jessica Chastain plays her as like a master deflector. Like, her mother's like, how are you affording this stuff? And she like totally like shifted the conversation.
She learned how to lie like they did.
Yeah,
if you're in it and you don't leave.
Yeah. But I feel like it waffles between the two.
It does.
You know, it instead of again showing her as the wolf in sheep's clothing, she ultimately is.
So are they trying to give the viewer like this like thought project of like, you know, you don't really know people's intentions, like people are good and bad, whatever.
I think that what they are trying to do is just make her into the sympathetic figure of the... Because, you know, the story wouldn't work if you didn't have a sympathetic protagonist.
Yeah, you've got to... Yeah.
Yeah. I'll postulate.
The whole scene with the puppet, like as a kid, when she's like using the puppet to like, right, to that talk. Was like creepy as
shit. But also that like
her, she's a creepy lady.
Her exclusion from the church because she was a child of, she was the product of an affair. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Her mother, you know, had sex with someone outside of her marriage and then ended up giving birth to her. And so, she was a scandal in the local
church. How outrageously common.
Right. Yeah.
Who gives a shit? These people get hung.
But that's the thing. I
mean, for a bunch of people that promote forgiveness, they get hung up on the most.
It's really weird to me how they show
another podcast.
They show some elements of how toxic this environment really is.
Yeah.
And yet they continue to pull their punches when it comes to actually casting blame. And
makes you wonder, doesn't it? Makes you wonder if anybody involved with the religious.
I'm sure they were afraid of some kind of a libel suit.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Oh, those people are that segment of society is immensely wealthy. Yeah. The religious right, evangelical. Right. They're like. I was going to say they're like the mafia. They are the mafia. Like they really do engage in mafia tactics. It's scary. It would not surprise me if this movie's script were bent to the will of those people in some way. Yep.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say they were litigious, which I could agree with that too. But
maybe.
Maybe.
I bet they are.
I've got nothing.
It's an interesting movie. I would say if it sounds something interesting to you, you know, definitely watch it.
I enjoyed watching it at the time.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll ever watch it again.
No, I agree.
There are plenty of these movies on this list that I'm going to go back and revisit just because enjoyed them or they were good. But this is one I've watched it. I don't know if I'm going to watch it ever again.
Yeah. Well, some of my favorite stuff is stuff that I'll never watch again.
Yeah.
Like Chernobyl.
I won't lie. I'm probably going to watch that again. Moonfall again when it streams. If only so you
can further understand how a star exists inside of the moon.
I need a shot by shot breakdown of how fucking stupid that movie is.
Can we get Neil deGrasse Tyson on Zoom and do an interview and talk about Moonfall with him?
I want to see that guy.
Neil, how does a star exist inside of the moon?
I want somebody to just be super, like, fucking mean about how they break down.
Yeah, I want a scientist to be like, okay,
this movie is.
Yeah. Here's why.
As long as we can also do a Patreon short where we interview Tammy Faye Baker, Gilbert Gottfried as Joel Osteen.
She died.
And
you know what?
Jared Leto as
the ghost of Tammy Faye Baker.
That's not a problem though. Jeremy has a book on necromancy.
I do.
Oh, good.
We'll just raise it from the top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, she was a sight in real life. Imagine her ghost.
Yeah.
It's just runny. It's just running. Yeah. Like the ectoplasm is just running off of her.
Yeah.
Well, I think that wraps up this episode.
I think our bad our impressions were hilarious. I think that wrapped up the episode.
I'm crying.
We should have just stopped with them.
Stop where we're ahead.
Gilbert Gottfried is.
We did a lot of impressions in this one.
We did. We got some good stuff.
So what do we have
so
coming up?
So many impressions. You just have to squint really hard at mic push.
We've got some fun stuff coming.
We're going to be at StokerCon.
We're going to be at StokerCon. If you're in Denver, you should come and check us out. We're pretty excited about that. We're both actually going to be there.
Yeah.
Through a miracle of modern science, we've found a way to clone me, apparently.
And the Slay House budget.
Yeah, I mean, really, thanks to the Slay Brothers.
Set up a tent there.
Slay and, siblings. We have to thank all of them.
Yeah, that's right. The Slay siblings. For
we're going to have some Patreon content coming up, too. We're going to have some stuff that you can only find on Patreon if you're a subscriber, including we're going to have shortly the Slay siblings have agreed to sit for portraits. And
that's right.
So we're going to have black and white images of them in our next
anthology.
But if you want to see full color portraits, those will only be found on Patreon to start.
We're also really excited to announce some new content that will be coming both to Patreon and to the podcast.
Yes.
We are going to start producing some audiobook readings of some classic stories. Those audiobook readings will only be available on our Patreon, so make sure that you follow along there. And hey, maybe consider giving us just a couple bucks a month.
Yeah.
Really does help pay a lot of the bills around here. We're also we just contracted 2 short stories that we will be reading on the show. We are projecting that those episodes are going to be ready sometime in July. So definitely stick around for that.
They will also be featured in our next anthology as well too.
That's right. So we don't want to. We don't want to. I don't know. Tease too much of some of the upcoming content that we have in case something goes wrong, but we're really excited about some potential author interviews coming up in the next few weeks. We just recorded a phenomenal episode with Rich Handley, comics historian. Definitely go back and listen to that episode if you did not listen to it yet. It is a real treat.
Really cool guy.
Fun interview. What else? We are open for book submissions. We're being very, very selective on what we want for books. But
starting July 1st, we are open for short story submissions for the next anthology. We are, like you say, we are currently looking for some novel submissions. So if you have a novel or a novel project that you'd like to pitch to us, please, you can send that to editor@slayhouse.com.
We have Twitter accounts.
Yep. We may not be open for too much longer with the novel submissions, depending on what we find. We are being very selective about it.
Yep.
But you can follow along at slayhouse.com for any information about our submissions.
Yep. Both the podcast and the publishing house have a Twitter presence. We've got an Instagram that we're trying to grow, but we're not done a lot with.
Same with TikTok. We are strategizing our TikTok strategy right now.
Sure, that's how we'll say it.
Yeah. But if you want to follow along with us on social media, you definitely should. We are at Slayhouse and at Slayhouse Litbit, SLEY. I don't know why I have to spell it because you're already listening to us, so you probably know us, but
spelled just like it there sounds. Not really.
And if
because anyone nobody spells it like this.
Anyone who's interested in what else is going on with Wayne Howard Studios, we've got a Patreon as well.
Yes.
It's patreon.com/Wayne Howard. A lot going on in this studio. We got a really cool group here and it's exciting.
Do you want to end this episode with a little bit of music from what you're doing?
Yeah. Actually, we got something ready for you. So
awesome.